ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of September. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. More than 800 people are dead and at least 2,500 are injured following one of the worst earthquakes in Afghanistan in recent years. Rescuers are struggling to reach remote areas in the quake zone in the country's northeast because of the rough terrain and bad weather. Ellie Grounds reports.
In Afghanistan's mountainous Kunar province, survivors of a powerful earthquake search beneath rubble, hoping to find their loved ones alive.
This is Mazar Dara in Nurgal district. The entire village was destroyed. Children and elders are trapped under the rubble. We need urgent help.
Kunar, in the country's northeast, has been hardest hit by the magnitude 6 quake, which struck near Afghanistan's fifth largest city, Jalalabad, on Sunday night. Video on social media showed people scrambling through rubble in the middle of the night, digging with their hands to try and rescue neighbours. Survivors have described seeing homes collapse before their eyes and hearing people screaming for help. This quake is one of the worst Afghanistan has seen in recent years. At just 8 kilometres deep, it's shallow, which often means more damage.
95% of our village has been destroyed. We have many martyrs and injured. In every house, at least 5 to 10 people are hurt.
Footage showed locals and Taliban soldiers working side by side to take the injured on stretchers and load them into helicopters bound for hospitals in Jalalabad and the capital, Kabul. A health ministry spokesperson said medical teams had arrived in impacted areas, but with remote, mountainous terrain, landslides and poor mobile reception, rescue efforts are being hampered. A lot is being left to local residents, who are pleading for help.
Some of our people are still buried under the soil. We need urgent help to rescue them. We need ambulances, doctors and everything necessary to save the injured and recover the dead.
Afghanistan was already in crisis before this quake. The UN says less than 30% of its humanitarian needs are covered for 2025. International assistance has dwindled since the Taliban returned to power. And help from the US, which last year provided 45% of its aid, has all but been eliminated under President Donald Trump's aid cuts. The pressure on a healthcare system already nearing breaking point will likely get worse, as rescue teams eventually manage to reach the worst areas of devastation, and the death toll inevitably climbs.
Ellie Grounds there. Russia's President Vladimir Putin and China's leader Xi Jinping are due to hold one-on-one talks later today. They're in China with other leaders from around Asia and the Global South for a major security summit as China tries to increase its diplomatic influence to rival the United States. China correspondent Alison Horn reports.
Walking the red carpet, some of the world's most powerful leaders greet China's Xi Jinping. Russia, India, Iran, all together for a security and economic summit of the Global South against a backdrop of US-led economic instability. Countries facing US sanctions or tariffs, part of a growing rift with Washington. Xi Jinping is offering a diplomatic hand to rival the United States.
At present, the international landscape is marked by intertwined changes and turbulence, and member states face increasingly arduous tasks in ensuring security and development.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin has previously described Xi Jinping as his best friend and backs in his allies' attempts to challenge the US-led global order.
This system could replace the outdated Europe Central and Euro-Atlantic models and would take into account the interests of a maximum number of countries, a system in which one group of countries would not ensure its security at the expense of others.
The two leaders are set to meet for bilateral talks on Tuesday, and Putin says he'll be sharing details of his recent summit with US President Donald Trump. China hasn't condemned nor supported the war in Ukraine, but she has offered to broker a peace deal, a proposal rejected by the US. But Putin is open.
We value the efforts and ideas of China, India and other strategic partners to solve the Ukrainian crisis. I hope the mutual understanding that was reached at a recent Russia-US summit in Alaska is heading in the same direction. I hope it paves the way to peace in Ukraine.
Putin will also this week attend a major military parade through the streets of Beijing, marking 80 years since the end of World War II. China's military has been in rehearsal for weeks. Also on the guest list, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Three of the most powerful men in the world, Xi, Putin and Kim, together for the first time. Trilateral talks haven't been announced, but their mere coming together will be a show of unity against the West. This is Alison Horn reporting for AM.
A warning, our next story might be disturbing for some listeners. Victim survivors of child sexual abuse want major changes to the way institutions handle material like child pornography. Research by Monash University shows many victim survivors feel a deep distrust and ongoing trauma over the retention and use of child sexual abuse material, even if it's for law enforcement purposes or child protection. They're asking for opt-in schemes and stricter duty of care rules in the use of this material. Catherine Gregory reports.
27-year-old Casey, which is not her real name, faces ongoing trauma as explicit sexual material taken of her as a child remains online and in the hands of police and courts.
It's also a real point of shame knowing that the person that you've been interviewed by is potentially the one going to be looking at the worst moments of your life, so that's really hard.
Her former boss took sexually exploitative videos of her, which she discovered on his computer and later reported to police.
So he's actually captured some incidents of contact offending on me when I was actually asleep, and then another time when I just wasn't facing him.
Casey feels re-victimised because it can't be wiped from the internet. And institutions like police and lawyers also access and store the material for evidence.
When it comes to forensic evidence that's digital, there's not a very great amount of communication about it. There's a long wait period for it, and it can be quite re-traumatising to know that that's being viewed, you know, one more time, let alone lots more times. You're dealing with a system that can't really prioritise your need to know or want to know.
Casey is one of more than 100 child sexual abuse victim survivors who were asked about child sexual abuse material by Monash University's Artificial Intelligence for Law Enforcement and Community Safety Lab. Kelly Humphreys is a research fellow there.
Many survivors who have experienced CSAT are afraid that people are going to know who they are by their material.
She's also a survivor.
We want to know what's happening throughout the process. So from seizure of material or identification all the way through to, like, say, the court process.
Kelly Humphreys says most survivors want transparency and control over how the material is used by authorities, although she knows it's almost impossible to stamp out online.
What happens is that material doesn't go away, right? It's perpetuating on the internet, on the dark web, and it is in the collection of perpetrators online.
Some victim survivors want to know each time that material is viewed. Others don't, so they're calling for an opt-in notification scheme for when institutions like police view the material.
We've been advocating for the establishment of the right to be notified here in Australia for many years.
Criminology professor Michael Salter is also the director of child protection body Childlight at UNSW.
There also needs to be transparency with victims and survivors about who has their material, where is it being stored, how is it being managed by law enforcement. We have databases of child sexual abuse material that are lawfully held all around the world. And that system has developed organically and spontaneously. It has not been designed with survivors in mind.
Criminology Professor Michael Salter, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. And if you've experienced childhood trauma or abuse, you can call the Blue Knot helpline on 1300 657 380. Politicians, policing authorities and child protection experts will meet at Parliament House in Canberra today to ensure that child protection remains a priority in Australia's approach to artificial intelligence. They want to criminalise tools that are created for the purpose of making child abuse material. The National Children's Commissioner, Anne Hollands, will be there and she joined me earlier. Anne Hollands, currently it's illegal to possess child abuse material, but there is a gap in the law where it's not illegal to possess AI-generated material. How urgent is it that it be outlawed?
Well, Sabra, we've heard a lot about AI lately, particularly in relation to how it can improve the productivity of the nation. This was all discussed at the Economic Reform Roundtable. But there's a dark side to AI, and this roundtable today is really about making child safety and wellbeing the priority in our considerations of how we can prevent harm to children, because AI itself, I mean, it's very rapidly developing, but it's already facilitating abuse of children, and we need some guardrails.
This meeting today with experts and you and an independent MP is leading the charge on this. Where is the federal government on the issue of fast-tracking action to stop the use of AI-enabled harms against kids?
Well, I understand there may well be some government officials there today as well, and I know that there is interest in this, but look, like with a lot of things to do with child safety and wellbeing, as we've just seen recently with the childcare sector crisis, we often wait and we wait until there's some kind of tragedy or crisis occurs before we act. And I think it's important that we get on the front foot and that we make child safety and wellbeing our priority.
Well, what needs to change and how quickly?
Well, the roundtable really will be discussing what needs to change. I mean, there's a lot of experts there, and I'm not a technical expert, of course. But we know that there's things like deep fake images are being shared, created and shared, and grooming of children by chatbots, sexualised chatbots, and I understand chatbots that have very human-like features. They make friends with, or children make friends with the chatbots, and there's a lot of negative outcomes that we're starting to hear about from around the world. Really, parents and schools need to be educated about these dangers for a start. Many schools already do a lot of great work in terms of addressing social media harms, but AI is a new area often for them. We need better training for police, for law enforcement. I mean, that's really important. And we need that regulation about, you know, making it a criminal offence to create or download or share this kind of technology that will actually facilitate abuse of children.
Social media was let loose on the public with minimal restrictions. Do you worry about the impact of artificial intelligence on society and how it's happening really quickly now and the guardrails are coming in place afterwards?
Well, we are already playing catch-up with AI. I think that's the reality of it. I think we need to move faster. And my observation as National Children's Commissioner has been that often when it comes to things that are negatively affecting children and their safety and well-being, we move at a snail's pace, if at all. I think that was proven recently, where we've waited 10 years to implement recommendations from 10 years ago. So, you know, we need to really get on the front foot here and not wait.
Last time we talked, you wanted a federal minister for children. Has the government explained why it hasn't appointed one, and perhaps would one at the cabinet table mean that this is taken seriously?
Well, it is my view that having a point of accountability in cabinet, an eyes on children, someone who has responsibility specifically for children, would have made a difference with matters in the past with the lack of action on evidence-based recommendations. And I say there's a good reason why we have a senior cabinet minister for women, for example. That's a great thing. There's good reasons for that, but we need that kind of accountability for children.
And on the issue of child safety, you touched on that earlier, child safety in childcare centres. Federal and state governments say they're moving quickly. Some measures started yesterday. Is that enough?
Look, it's kind of too early to say whether it's enough, because we have to sort of wait to see these reforms roll out. I mean, some of them aren't going to start until next year. Of course, I've commended the strong leadership of the Commonwealth government on this and the collaboration across the Federation to now fast track these long overdue reforms. But I think there will be a lot more to do. For example, with the working with children's checks, which everyone's heard about now, it's very complex and it's not clear how we're going to reconcile the differences across the states and territories with how those checks are done. And, you know, importantly, in one of the bits of their communique from the education ministers meeting that didn't get a lot of media was the fact that they're actually going to change the law governing the childcare sector to make the safety, the rights and the best interests of children the paramount consideration. Now, this is very important. It's actually a game changer, given that we've seen that the system as it currently exists is geared towards protecting the adults and government administrations, not the children in their care. But it is really unclear at this stage how this principle of making the best interests of children the priority, how it will be implemented. And we need to work through that to ensure accountability for the transformation of the industry.
Anne Hollands, thanks for joining AM.
Thanks, Saba.
And Anne Hollands is the National Children's Commissioner. The federal government this morning has announced a commitment to make laws to stamp out the use of technology in making nude images and undetectable online stalking tools and apps. A warning, our next story is about the culture at the Australian Defence Force and includes discussion about domestic violence and suicide. An ABC investigations found a violent repeat abuser was allowed to remain in their rank and a tyrannical, toxic leader was given a slap on the wrist. A year after the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide handed down its findings, serving members fear lessons haven't been learnt. Laura Lavelle has this story.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I present the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide final report.
It's been nearly a year since Julianne Finney sat crying in the gallery of Parliament House while Defence Minister Richard Marles tabled the report from the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide, the very Royal Commission she fought tooth and nail to have established after her son David Finney took his own life in 2019.
This report is for David. It is for David and the many others like him who have worn our nation's uniform.
After 3 years of hearings, nearly 6,000 submissions, a 3,000-page report and 122 recommendations, the moment should have felt like closure.
Well, it was horrible. I realised that I hadn't won anything. It was just the beginning.
Since then, current and ex-serving members keep calling her, saying the issues exposed during the investigation are still rife.
They're not changing anything. Not anything that needs to be changed.
Jack, not his real name, is a serving member. He says Defence turned its back on him after he was assaulted by his ex-partner. Here, Jack is voiced by an actor to protect his identity.
I was losing hearing from my ear, my jaw was swelling up, I had blood spurting from my mouth, from my nose, my eye was closing up, I had blood all over my face.
Court transcripts show in an almost identical incident, his attacker had previously assaulted another serviceman. The abuser was sentenced in court for both offences, but was never stood down from the ADF. And Jack says the ADF didn't offer much support.
For a period of time there, a lot of those thoughts turned to taking my own life. I felt like I've been treated like a problem.
In a separate incident, the ABC understands a senior defence leader who had more than a dozen substantiated reports of unacceptable behaviour still continued on a promotional course. He was described in a report as toxic and tyrannical, who repeatedly bullied, belittled, harassed and humiliated his subordinates.
This is the sort of conduct and behaviour that the Royal Commission had countless stories about.
That's Associate Professor James Connor, a military sociology expert from UNSW.
Because currently, the victims are not only the victims of that violence within the ADF, They're then victimised by the processes which protect the perpetrators.
In a statement, the ADF says any form of violence or inappropriate behaviour has no place within defence, apologising to those who have experienced cultural issues. It said any personnel found guilty of serious offences can face a range of disciplinary actions, including involuntary separation.
Laura Lavelle there. And if you're a current or former ADF member and this story has raised concerns for you or someone you know, you can contact Open Arms on 1800 011 046. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's one man against the might of the Victorian police force, but still, alleged police killer Desi Freeman remains on the run. So, how are police approaching the surge? And how long are they willing to keep going? Today, former hostage negotiator Vince Hurley. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.